Shrink Wrap Radio number 318, Understanding Problem Kids with Dr. Nancy Rappaport.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Dr. Nancy Rappaport, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you on Shrink Wrap Radio, having previously interviewed you for my Wise Counsel podcast about your 2010 book, In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. And now we're into a very different kind of book.
It's definitely a different kind of book. That was a memoir written from a very personal experience, and this is drawing on my experience of working with schools for 20 years.
Yes, yes. And so you and you have a co-author, Jessica Minahan, and you have this 2012 book. 2012, that just sounds so futuristic. I just stumbled over it. You have a 2012 book out about working with problem kids. What led to the writing of this book?
You know, I had recognized that there was a gap in the literature and that teachers and parents were really looking for more direction around concrete strategies that they could implement in the classroom. And I'd had a student that I had, I'm an associate professor at Harvard, and I'd written an article about a student principal called from 0 to 100 in a split second. And I'd asked experts around the country to kind of weigh in on it. But the person who made the difference was Jessica, because she was, she's a behavior analyst and was working in the classroom providing support to the teachers. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to create a partnership, many times when I work in schools, I'm asked to do safety assessments after a child has exploded or done something aggressive to a teacher or another student. And I really wanted us to be able to strengthen how schools can support kids who may have challenging behavior before they get to a point where there's a question about whether they need to be in a more restrictive setting.
I was a little surprised to encounter the term behavior analyst as a role at a school. I didn't know that existed. I mean, I know what behavior analysis is, I think, yeah. You know, based on behaviorism and so on. But what can you tell us about that?
I wish my co-author was here to do justice to it,
yes.
But she's why we were complementary is, as a child psychiatrist, you're often thinking about what's the underlying diagnosis? Is there attentional deficit, or is there depression, or is there oppositional behavior, and what are the kinds of setting events that might have happened, a parent dying or a child's biological predisposition. A behavioral analyst is trained to really scrutinize the behavior and look for the antecedents, the things that are going on prior to the behavior, and then hone in on how can we shift our response to shape a child's behavior. And I think our approach is complementary, because I worked hard in our discussions together to try to make the narrative of how we were describing the interventions not have people think, are we trying to turn students into mice, but mm-hmm. to really appreciate the kinds of changes that you can make in the environment that can significantly enhance how a student functions in the school. And behavioral analysts or school psychologists and social workers have been increasingly asked to become more sophisticated around looking at the behavior and trying to figure out how to modify the environment because of some of the special ed law changes in the context of not resorting to suspensions and detentions in schools, but trying to modify the environment.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Now, the title of this book is The Behavior Code. What's behind that name? It seems like maybe it implies something.
Right. It's not like the Da Vinci Code, but in some ways what it's meant to highlight is a lot of times when a child acts up in school, you'll find educators saying, you know, why did he do this? You know, and sometimes that you may end up, and again, I have tremendous respect for teachers and educators, but they may resort to thinking of a child as being manipulative or just sort of being a bad kid that just wants to come to school to undermine their authority. And this is meant to say, to really invite parents and educators to be curious about why a behavior happens and not to make assumptions, because that's when you can get into trouble. And so the behavior code is meant to say, instead of saying what, you know, why did he do that? To say, what is he trying to communicate? And that really shifts, I hope, how you begin to piece together an appropriate response.
And it sounds like maybe it's an attempt to be less judgmental, to focus on the behavior rather than this is a bad kid.
Yeah, I guess a little bit of both. I'd say to be less judgmental, but also to be more effective. Mm-hmm. So many times when I have gotten what are called incident reports from the school, which are write-ups about what's happened with a child becoming explosive, the major emphasis is on when the child has exploded. And what's really important in the aspect of the behavior code is to really begin to put a magnifying glass on what was going on prior to the explosion, because that's usually where you want to do the intervention.
Okay.
And parents may have a good sense of that. Say, for instance, when you go to the mall with your 4 or 5 year old kid, that they may have a significant temper tantrum. And what you want to think about is, how do I manage my child around the transition of leaving the store, rather than focusing on how to manage the outburst once the child's leaving the store.
It's almost too late at that point.
Exactly.
Right?
You're behind. Once you have a meltdown, you're really playing catch up.
Yeah. You and your co-author developed what you call the FAIR plan, the F-A-I-R plan. And since F-A-I-R is all in caps, I'm thinking it might be an acronym.
It is, and that's partly because educators love acronyms.
But, oh, no.
So we had a lot of, we sometimes thought about misspelling the FAIR so that we could get in all the aspects of it. But we really developed that acronym to help teachers remember this and parents remember the steps involved in deciphering behavior and developing an effective plan. So F is for understanding the function of the behavior. A is for accommodations, I is for interaction strategies, and R is for responses. And what we chose to focus on and design the FAIR plan for were students or children who had anxious behavior, oppositional behavior, or withdrawn behavior, or who have sexualized behavior, because these students often experience failure and are the most misunderstood in school.
What can you tell us about the function of the behavior?
Well, there is a behavioral psychologist, Mark Duran, who outlined, and I think this is super useful for both parents and teachers, to look at the possible functions of behavior. And the categories are to escape, to get a tangible thing, to engage in sensory activities, or to get attention. Hmm. And this, looking at behavior this way, describes the benefit students can get from the behavior, a benefit that they may not even be aware of, and then help us understand how to intervene to help students change the behavior. So just to give you an example with escape-motivated behavior, if a student attempts to avoid a task, demand, situation, or person, say, for example, you have a student who runs out of the classroom during reading. That's fairly obvious that they're, he might be trying to escape from reading. But sometimes it can be less obvious. For instance, if a student or a child starts to argue to get out of doing an activity that makes them anxious, what can happen is then they can get a timeout or be sent to the student's sent to the principal's office. And this can accidentally reinforce escape-motivated behavior because the student learns, you know what, if I end up getting an argument, then I'm going to, and it's not always conscious, but I'm going to get exactly what I wanted, which was to not have to do the behavior, not have to do the activity that I didn't want to do.
Yes, yes, that makes sense. Now there are dogs howling in the background here. I don't know if you can hear them or not.
I can't, no.
Oh, good. Now, much of your book seems addressed to teachers and the classroom setting. Am I right, though, that the practices that you describe would be equally applicable in the home for parents of difficult children?
They're really for educators. So it could be a school psychologist or a social worker or a teacher. And definitely it's been utilized for parents who may have children who are oppositional or anxious and want to have, you know, want to be able to be informed about what are reasonable expectations to want from their teachers in working with their children. And also it's a cheat sheet for them. A lot of these suggestions are adaptable to their own parenting. So, for instance, one of the things you have with an oppositional child might be that they want to debate with you about everything that you're going to ask them to do. So one of our suggestions would be to write a note on a sticky mm-hmm. note and put it in front of the child, walk away, don't make eye contact. And how that can be helpful is it gets you out of the verbal debate mm-hmm. and it gives a child a certain amount of time to kind of regroup. And it doesn't give the kind of attention that can end up happening when you're in a big verbal debate with your child. So that's an example of sort of a very concrete suggestion of just trying a sticky and seeing if that works. Another one is a delay in asking a child to do something. So it's not about, you know, you need to do it now, which frequently when things are escalated, the demands from the adult can be fairly pressured. But if you give them a few minutes, you know, I'll need you to pick up everything within, you know, 10 minutes before we head to the library, it avoids the power struggle as much.
You know, these kinds of concrete tips make me think of the TV show, The Super Nanny.
And oh, yeah.
I just felt like I was going to have to work that in here somewhere.
Maybe we should rename the book, The Behavior Code, Super Nannies. Tips for parents and kids. I should have, instead of us, that should have been the subtitle, instead of a practical guide to understanding and teaching the most challenging students, which sounds more daunting than Super Nanny Tips. Close
yeah,
note.
well, Super Nanny, really, it seems she must be getting coached by somebody somewhere. Because
she's good at what she does.
Yeah, she seems to bring really sort of cutting-edge tips and tricks into her interventions. Do you know who her advisor is?
I don't, but you know, the other thing she does use is humor, and that's one of the other really important things when you have, mm-hmm. when you're struggling with a child, or is not, you don't want to use humiliation and sort of taunting, which of course none of us want to do, but somehow being able to lighten the mood a little bit so it doesn't seem as high stakes, but you're still creating an expectation can be really useful.
Yeah. Now, you focus on four kinds of problem kids. What are the four types, and why those four instead of maybe some others?
Sure. So the first that we discuss, and we spend a fair amount of time, is the anxious child who may be easily frustrated, startled, or upset. And she may or he may have difficulty completing work, having somatic complaints such as stomachs or be irritable or angry. And why we felt that these students are really important to highlight is because children who may have anxious behavior coupled with being explosive, they what usually is very puzzling to both, you know, parents and educators is that when we were talking about antecedents, behaviors, and consequences and looking for patterns, often with kids with anxiety, it's actually, who have explosive behavior, it's not always consistent patterns. And that's actually a tip-off that it may be anxiety. And so one day you can make a demand on them and they're perfectly cooperative. The next time they have an explosion, and if you don't get that it's an underlying problem with anxiety, it can have you chasing your tail.
Mm-hmm.
So what we'll say is, okay, with an anxious child, here are some concrete tips that might be useful for kids with anxiety, and talk about interaction strategies that are useful. So in, you know, scheduling regular breaks can be useful, helping develop the skill of self-calming practices such as deep breathing or progressive muscle relaxation in and out of the classroom or at home, helping the student create a self-regulation chart about what to do when I feel X. And those are things that a lot of times with kids with anxiety, what may happen, both with parents and teachers, is they stop making demands because they're so worried about the explosions.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a kid sort of slip through and get to be sixth grade where it's really difficult then to make the intervention. So we're really encouraging early on to be able to identify those kids who are struggling with anxiety.
Right. And what are the other three kinds?
And the other one, which we briefly mentioned about, was the oppositional child, which, again, sometimes can be a kid who's anxious. But those are kids who have frequent tantrums and angry outbursts, will argue and question rules and often blame others for his or her mistakes. And what's important there is to embed choice, such as allowing the student to pick the order of assignments or the material to use or the place to sit and work. It's kind of like when you have a toddler and mm-hmm. you say, you know, do you want the blue chair or the red chair?
Yes.
And sometimes with these kids, you may have to have an alternative recess with fewer students, with more structure. And it's sometimes counterintuitive, but you really want to avoid power struggles at the same time as sometimes adults, when they will end their request to, and you can see it in the supermarket all the time, request to an oppositional kid with okay when making a demand. And that's not, you don't want to do that, because if you have an oppositional kid, they're going to say, no, it's not okay. And the other thing is to really try to set limits that are enforceable and clear and simple, and that can be a challenge. And the next category that we had was the withdrawn child, and that's someone who may have low energy or motivation to work and can be irritable and may refuse to go to school or act clingy with a teacher or feel something bad's going to happen. And some older children may sulk or act bored. And again, if in the psychiatrist's language with me, it wouldn't be as much focusing on the behavior. It would be on the why of the withdrawn child. But here it's really saying, you know, it's appropriate if you have a child that's withdrawn to have them have a buddy system during recess that might be facilitated by an adult,
mm-hmm.
or use pictures to help the student think of and maintain a topic that they might write for a short story, and help with them being able to identify positive thinking skills. And trying to figure out with the student what are positive feedbacks that they're comfortable with. Sometimes when you give a child who's withdrawn too much positive feedback, they'll shut down. So, you know, the last thing is to help with sometimes being able to highlight the times when they're having positive social interactions, because sometimes a withdrawn child will tend to magnify the times when they're isolated, and you want to sort of help with them with that.
Yeah, help them to reframe it, understand
yep.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can see how, in some ways, this is building on what we may know as clinicians, the idea
yes.
that, you know, with a withdrawn child, they may think on the downside. They might magnify the negative. but right. sort of saying, how do you integrate that in a really practical way?
Okay. Is there a fourth hanging out there? I think we've done
sexualized behavior.
Yeah, okay, great.
And that's sexualized behavior. Thank you for prompting me. you know, sexualized behavior is that kind of behavior that may be come from kids with poor social skills who may have Asperger's or autism, and kids who have problems with impulsivity or kids with trauma.
Okay, well, if we pull back a little bit to the social context, in the book you point out that about 10% of kids in school, about 9 to 13 million students, struggle with mental health problems. What are some of the psychosocial stressors that kids face today? What's going on with this particular generation that they, you know, are they under more stress than kids used to be?
You know, it's a good question, and, you know, probably having a sociologist would be better at addressing that. But what I can say is that it's similar to the debate about Asperger's. Are we better at becoming more refined in our diagnosis and picking up those children who are struggling? And that's partly why we have, you know, a significant number of children that may be struggling in our schools. And the other aspect is many of these kids may not have made it in school and would have been, you know, asked to leave or been in separate school settings. So that's another aspect of why there may be more challenges in the general education at this point. And that's partly another aspect is a lot of teachers don't get the kind of support around how they'll look at, you know, terrific instruction with how to teach reading, but not as much direct instruction around how to manage the challenges of kids who may be struggling with anxious behavior or oppositional behavior. And, you know, there's nothing that makes a parent or a teacher feel more frustrated than when they want success and they are confronted with the limitations of their approach. And that's why we wanted to provide something that could jumpstart them.
What can you tell us about medication? We have the impression that so many kids today are on medication.
Well, you know, that's a hot debate.
Yes.
And, you know, I have of two minds. I am a child psychiatrist, and I do prescribe medications, and I think there is a role for medication for children who are significantly impaired by an underlying diagnosis such as attention disorder or a major depression, where medications can significantly help a child function and address the underlying deficit of a neurotransmitter. At the same time, I'd want to highlight that the reason I teamed up with a behavioral analyst is I think ourselves as parents and as school educators, we have a responsibility to maximize our support of students around both understanding and environmental interventions that can help a kid. And where we may end up getting kids who receive medications and may not always benefit is around those students who are oppositional. And they may look like they're distractible and unable to concentrate, but it's actually that they're just defying authority, and a stimulant may not make them look better. So I think it's a, you know, I think there's a role for medication. You want a good, thorough diagnostic evaluation and not, a speedy, quick fix. And we want to have that be complementary to the other kinds of support that's given.
Yeah, in relation to not a speedy, quick fix, one of the things that you point out is that many times the professionals reach out too quickly for psychiatric medications before trying other kinds of the sorts of interventions that you two write about.
Yeah, I've seen both things happen. I've seen parents wait and exhaust all options, and by that time a child has a major error history, in that if they're really an impulsive child with a strong family history of ADD, attention deficit disorder, and you wait till they're in sixth grade to think of a medication trial because you're really worried about the impact of it, you sometimes have kids who really have a developed identity of either being a class clown or that they don't do school, when it's just that they're really impulsive and have been in constant trouble. So I've seen that, and then I've seen the other side where sometimes you have medication without the other really important interventions that teach kids skills, because that's what we really want to do. And sometimes you'll have educators say, well, that's not my responsibility. And I'd say, well, then if there's a school social worker, reach out to them and see if, you know, you can think together about what are the skills that need to happen. And we wrote this so that there, at the end of each chapter, there's sort of a checklist that a parent could bring to a meeting that they were having around their child's individual ed plan, if they're a special ed student. And they could say, you know, one of the things my child struggles with is being able to calm down and getting dysregulated super quickly. And I was hoping that we could introduce some self, in some emphasis on him learning the skills for self-calming. And that, to me, would be a really exciting development to have happen in our schools routinely.
Yes. Now, you mentioned the class clown. I could almost see that as being a fifth category.
Is there one of the four
that you did mention that class clown would sort of tend to fall under?
That's a terrific question. My guess would be it would be around somewhat of oppositional. I mean, if you're a class clown and you make everyone laugh, then nobody really cares. It's when you're a class clown and you're derailing the momentum of the class that it becomes more of an oppositional kind of, where a teacher may need to be thinking about how to, you know, is it attention seeking, and how else can the student get attention?
Yeah. Which type of behavioral disorder is it that teachers most dread having in class?
Oppositional.
Okay, because...
I think explosive kids. You know, I think I think both anxious and oppositional. Anxious because it's unpredictable, and they're not always sure how to help a student get less anxious. And the kind of reassurance that they might do doesn't always work with really anxious kids, and they have to do some more skill building for them. And I think oppositional kids are just exhausting, because you ask them to get in line and maybe they end up getting in a fight when they get in line because they have problems with waiting. But if you shift and you say, you know what, we need to figure out how to manage the fact that this little guy or girl has problems with waiting, and what can we concretely put in place to help with him waiting. And, you know, Jess has been in situations with kids who really are escalated, where they'll actually have like a bag of waiting toys that they'll use, where a paraprofessional will stand next to them. Basically, what you first do is try to accommodate what the child isn't able to do, and then teach them a replacement strategy. So that's a key aspect, is that you first want to just eliminate the outburst by hook or by crook. And you may make accommodations that you're not going to keep long term, while you're getting momentum for them to be able to function better.
Your mention of waiting reminds me again of the super nanny, and she has parents do a timeout, typically putting them on the naughty step or the naughty chair or the naughty corner. And she gauges the time by their age, so that a 3-year-old sits on the naughty step for 3 minutes, and the 4-year-old, it would be 4 minutes, so that there's some recognition of a developmental capacity to wait.
So is that the way that she's trying to teach them about waiting, or that sounds more like that's just a short, I'm not familiar with that aspect of her show.
Oh,
but it's just something
she does. I think it's interesting, though, that she, it just recognizes that she, at different stages of chronological development, a kid will, there are limits to what is reasonable to ask of a kid in terms of waiting or other kinds of behaviors.
Yeah.
And the timeout is basically a kind of waiting, you know, waiting to be able to.
What I meant, though, is say you had a parent who has a child, every time they go to take a bath, they have a child hates a bath and starts to throw things around the room.
Okay.
And you put them on the quote-unquote naughty steps, which I think I'd probably rename. What you may be inadvertently doing is reinforcing the behavior, because what the child learns is I hate taking a bath, and if I have a temper tantrum, I get to put it off for 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd want to end up thinking, that's the thing that we're talking about with our readers, is you want to really be a detective and figure out, if you're doing the naughty steps every night, then there's something wrong with your intervention.
Sure.
And you want to step back and think about, is there some way that I'm actually reinforcing that behavior, even though I think I'm intervening in a way to change it?
Yes. You point out that sometimes teachers lower the academic bar just so that they don't have to deal so much with the explosive students. And but you suggest that there are other choices maybe that could be made.
Well, I think partly what happens is if you have a child who every time you place a demand on them, they explode, then you're going to think, you know what, I just don't have to deal with Mary right now. And, you know, particularly sometimes, again, what parents may think is what I need so that my child can function is a one-on-one aid. And so, and they'll get into knockdown battles with school systems to try to get a one-on-one aid. And I'm really cautious about introducing a one-on-one aid, because it doesn't necessarily mean that the child's going to learn the skills that they need to be able to function in the classroom. It may mean that, just as we talked about, that the child will sort of be off in the corner with a one-on-one aid kind of managing the behavior, but really having reduced expectations about what they're going to produce. So I would much rather have a teacher find small incremental steps that a student can achieve, and then move them along to expanding the expectation. And let's just say we have a child who's explosive because they're anxious that they're not going to be able to do it. Then it would be around previewing the assignment prior to being started in the classroom, and maybe even having the child do the first problem at the beginning so they have the confidence that they can actually do the problem. And then when it's introduced in the classroom, you don't have the child sort of crumpling up the paper and throwing it across the room or something like that.
Yeah. That fourth category that you mentioned of sexually provocative, and I think many people would make the assumption that a sexually provocative child has been sexually abused or overexposed at home, but you say that's not always the case.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That was important to me, because I've done safety assessments, intensive sort of psychiatric assessments, where schools will be poised to file against the family. And there are, you know, you certainly want to consider the possibility of sexual abuse, but there are times when that's not the case, and then you end up having the parent and the school pitted against each other in a way that's really unfortunate. So, you know, when you have kids that may have sexualized behavior, in our clinical experience, it could be children with interpersonal social skill deficits, so children with Asperger's or autism, or children with impulsivity or exposure to trauma, certainly, which would fall into the category you're talking about. But with impulsiveness, it can also be children who may have early onset bipolar disorder or have attentional difficulties where they're disinhibited. And, you know, for those children with students with social deficits, it may result from a lack of understanding what's okay to say and do and what isn't. And more importantly, when we talked about the four types of Duran's types of behavior, where you talk about escape, attention, tangible, or sensory, if a child with interpersonal skill deficits learns that if I say something like armpit or whatever body part you want to insert in there, that it gets a swift and quick response, they may, from a peer and adult, then they may end up repeating that because they, you know, they're craving the attention. And other times it can be a way to express frustration and anger in students who have learned that sexualized comments are taboo. So that's, you know, that's one example. And what was, and for students who are severely impulsive, who may act before they think, they can often say things that they know are inappropriate, but they just don't stop to think before and blurt them out. And
so each case has to be really evaluated on its individual merits.
And what we found was, which is fascinating to me, that when we did lit search, almost nothing had been written about how to respond to kids with sexualized behavior, which I thought was, you know, sort of like equivalent to the elephant in the room. Because if you ask most seasoned teachers, and certainly teachers who are just beginning, or parents, you know, what's one of the most troubling kinds of behavior? It's kids who have this kind of sexualized behavior. It can really be unsettling.
Well, again, we don't have a sociologist in the room, but I have to wonder about the things that kids are exposed to in the media. And, you know, there's an awful lot of very sexualized material in the media these days, thinking particularly of television and movies and, you know, all kinds of innuendo and inside jokes that supposedly children aren't going to get. But it seems to me there's a lot of evidence that children get exposed to a lot and understand a lot of the insinuation.
I agree that that's probably an accurate analysis. And at the same time, you know, this is focusing, you know, it's, you know, I'm trying to take pity on the teacher or the parent, and that we can't, you know, we can modify some of these.
Sure.
But what you don't want to end up having is having a teacher or parent say, you know, well, particularly with a parent, they have a lot more control about what their child sees on TV or is exposed to. But if a teacher just says, you know, what's the teacher to do, because, you know, there's just so much rampant sexualized material out there that kids are being exposed to, that's a problem. Because as school educators, I want us to be thinking about how do we help with self-regulation and self-monitoring and that kind of thing. What are our interaction and our response strategies to students who make sexualized statements? How do we help with students who may consistently invade peers' personal space? So, you know, I'm not, I think it's accurate to say there can be multiple contributions to sexualized behavior, and this is a beginning tapping the surface to support teachers and educators and parents when they're being confronted with this kind of challenging behavior.
Right. Now, you give some examples in the book, kind of little mini case history type examples, and one that you write about is a misunderstanding with Hannah, a kindergarten girl who screams at another student to get off a beanbag. And the point that you make is that often we make the wrong assumptions. I think that's kind of been running throughout our conversation here, that that we can make wrong assumptions about what's behind the child's behavior, and that can get in the way of effectively addressing the problem. So,
in that kind of situation, you could have the teacher give them a lecture about how they need to wait their turn and that they need to be better at sharing. But it and that's possible that the student is struggling with sharing. It also could be that they are rigid and inflexible, and they're predicting that they are going to need that chair because that's the chair they always sit at when they do their math. And so what you want to be able to do is to come up with an alternative about, with a child like that, about is it that they can accept an alternative plan and that you all have thought about it together so that that she doesn't panic in the moment, that she's not going to have the coping mechanism that she might have had to, when she's faced with a challenging situation.
You say it's really important for parents and professionals to stay curious in order to find good solutions.
And, you know, again, that goes back to what we talked about at the beginning around the behavior code, which is, and that, you know, the title of the book, because what we're trying to say is that you may make an assumption that a child is not being able to share when, or here's another example, a child may be trying to get a, who has limited social skills, may be trying to get another peer's attention. So they may yell loudly at the student and elbow them. And, you know, you could definitely tell them about the fact that they need to be respectful of the student's boundaries. But if it's truly a social skill deficit, the way you're going to avert that happening again is by helping them learn what are appropriate ways to get to make a friend and to try to initiate a conversation. And, you know, there's some wonderful curriculum that Michelle Garcia Winner has around social skill building, and we've really tried to build off of many of the different kinds of curriculums that are out there, like responsive classroom interventions, to say when you have kids that are really struggling and explosive, how do you ramp up with complementary emphasis for these kids?
Mm-hmm. Can you give maybe parents some tips for children who are argumentative and have a short fuse?
Prayer. No. I think what's important first is, as I talked about before, is to embed choice.
Yeah.
And that's whether it's around, you know, really decide when it's safety and it's a top priority, those are non-negotiables. But whether they sit in the front or the back seat or eat apples or bananas for a certain meal or, you know, do you want to use the crayon or the pencil? But trying to introduce choice, I think, can be very important. And avoiding yes or no questions and power struggles so that you, and then, as we talked about before, giving a demand and then moving away and avoiding eye contact. And another common thing I think I see with a lot of parents is they use way too many words when they're negotiating with their kids. Just really try to have concise questions.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. And also the super nanny says that too.
Right.
I've given her so much.
I'm glad. I'm you know, super nanny figured out how to get, which is what I wanted to do. I wanted us to get out to parents and educators and be able to provide them quick, thoughtful ways of approaching it. So she struck a chord for you. That's good.
Yeah. Well, I've just, recommend the show if you haven't checked it out. She somehow she keeps coming up with a variety of very sort of concrete helping tools, like special games or materials to hang on the wall and so on. Who knows what the long-term effects are?
Mm-hmm.
TV, of course, quotes reality TV, isn't necessarily reality.
Right. The golden rule.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot more that is in your book that we could cover, but I think maybe we should begin to wind down here.
Sure.
I wonder if there are any final points that you'd like to make before we do.
Well, one would be that, besides watching the Nanny Code, that if there are parents that want to help teachers, that we had someone say that instead of getting them a mug, to get the behavior code as a way of, you know, supporting their teachers being able to reach kids. And certainly they can either, the Harvard Ed Press has these books, and so does Amazon. So love to have any of your listeners have a chance to take a look, and particularly to emphasize that anxious children, oppositional kids, withdrawn children, and children with sexualized behaviors, that if we can arm ourselves with helping them to learn the skills they need, that, you know, kids would behave if they could. And part of our job as caring parents and educators is to be thoughtful with ourselves about what our children trying to communicate, and then teach them the skills about how to get the need met, whether it's for attention or for something tangible, without interfering with their ability to function. And, you know, I hope they enjoy our book. Jessica and I spent, you know, a fair bit of time to get it into a readily accessible way of, you know, practical suggestions.
Yeah, and I think you eminently succeeded. And so I give a hearty endorsement of your book and of your recommendation. Dr. Nancy Rappaport, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure, and I hope if anyone wants to contact me, it's nancyrappaport.com, and I'd be happy to continue the conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Nancy Rappaport. One of the key points I take away from our discussion is the vital importance of observing the event or events that precede the problem behavior. Another is that positive attention or positive reinforcement is not always the right approach, despite what we've heard over the years. It's not that positive reinforcement doesn't work. Rather, it's that without careful analysis, you may be reinforcing the wrong thing, something that actually supports the behavior you're hoping to eliminate. If you are a parent or a teacher, I think you'll find her book, The Behavior Code, to be a very practical and authoritative guide. I like her suggestion at the end of the interview that it could be given as a gift to a parent or teacher. I would suggest, however, that you do so very tactfully. Otherwise, the gift might be taken as an implied criticism. I do think that for anyone who deals with one or more challenging kids, there are very valuable practical tips and guidelines offered by the authors. In fact, the Behavior Code is currently being featured in the right-hand sidebar of our website at shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can order your copy through Amazon.com just by clicking on the book cover in the right-hand sidebar, which will take you directly to the book's page on Amazon.
Can you imagine your world without Shrink Wrap Radio? If you've become addicted to the show and need your Dr. Dave psychology fix on a regular basis, then you have to, need to, got to, go to the website and click on the big green donate button. The more you donate, the better you feel. It's easy and gratification is instant.
Thank you, brother-in-law Michael West, for that very professional promo and for your staunch support of what I'm up to here. And thanks to all of you for your donations, past, present, and hopefully future. Let me extend a big welcome to any new listeners out there. I'm happy to welcome you to our listener community, and I hope you'll keep coming back for more, as so many have done here. Well, it's hard to believe how quickly time moves along, but it's only about a week before I head off to Stockholm, where I'll be offering a 2-day workshop on dreams on Saturday and Sunday, September 8 and 9. You can find full details on the site. Just click on the Swedish flag icon in the right-hand sidebar on our site, and that will give you all the information you need to sign up. It's not too late. We've still got room. If you have trouble swinging the deposit in time, no sweat. Just show up with a bag of Swedish krona and you'll be fine. All you Europeans, hop on a Ryanair and come to our workshop. Even if you don't have a bag of Swedish krona, we'll be happy to exchange whatever coinage money you bring. Hey, I've got a new continuing education course to announce. I'm happy to announce a new body-mind course. It's called Body-Mind, Goodbye to Dualism. And it's 6 continuing education units. The course consists of 7 interviews covering the topic of body-mind. And I'll probably have yet another course to announce in this series by the very next show. So we will end up with way more than 60 units that are there and you can earn by just listening to these podcasts, and there are more on the way, as I say, and at around $10 per unit, they're a real bargain. Now, this is the go-to place for all you professionals, regardless of your discipline, to earn those continuing ed units that you need. So just go to the store tab on our site for full details. And we have a new transcript thanks to Jeremy Devins, Shrink Wrap Radio number 96, Body Mind Healing Psychotherapy with Dr. Michael Mayer. So thanks so much for that, Jeremy, and do contact me if you would be interested in being a volunteer transcriber. Thanks to all of you who have liked us on our new Facebook page. We're now up to 134 likes there and climbing.
Hi, this is Dr. Paul Swingle, author of Biofeedback for the Brain, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, indeed, Dr. Paul Swingle will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. But first, let's dip into our electronic mailbag once again for the latest from our listener community. First, we hear from Richard, who responded to my thanks for his donation by writing, "Hi, David. Wish I could give more. I'm an avid podcast listener, and yours is now in my top 5 recommendations to family and friends. The other 4 are Krista Tippett's On Being, WNYC's Radio Lab, Buddhist Geeks, and The Long Now. I also like the secular Buddhist CBC's Tapestry, Conversations from the Pale Blue Dot, and Fora TV. I also graze from time to time on a good number of the BBC and CBC radio shows that are on podcasts. I try to divide my donations up between the shows that really probe new and interesting ideas about the human condition, particularly in regards to what brings meaning and purpose to our lives. From microtubules to dreams as puzzles, I've been introduced to or reminded of so many important topics by you and your guests that I feel enlivened and motivated to a deeper kind of living. And I have probably only scratched the surface. I think I've listened to about 30 of your interviews." Oh, yes, you have only scratched the surface. "My iTunes only goes back to episode number 224. Is there a way to access the others from inside iTunes, or do I have to go to the website and download them one by one? Thanks, Richard." Richard, thanks again for your donation. And what a great list of inspiring podcasts you have. I've listened to a few of those, and I feel very honored to be in their number and to be one of the 5 that receives your support. And the question about listening to back podcasts is a really good one. Right now, the feed is limited to the most recent 75 podcasts on iTunes. Now, I do have some archival links on iTunes. If you go to the iTunes store, and you do a search on Shrink Wrap Radio, you'll find that three or four of my logos show up, and each one takes you to a different group. And the first logo is the one that has the most recent 75 shows. The other logos are intended to take you to archival shows, and you will be able to hear some of them if you subscribe to those. However, some of the archived shows no longer play on iTunes, and I'm not sure why, and I've written them about it, and I haven't gotten any response. But I know if you clicked on one, there was one I think that if you clicked on that you could get back to episode 2007. I think it was on Podcast Box if you subscribe to the app, which ends up being called Podcast Box. You can find the information about that on the website under apps. You can actually listen to 110 shows recently. It goes back all the way to 207. The reason why I've limited to 75 in iTunes is I've been told that if the feed gets too large, then either iTunes or FeedBurner will drop it. And FeedBurner is kind of an important part of my mix too. So I'm in the process of trying to figure out if there's any way other than going to the website and downloading them one at a time to get them on some kind of a podcatcher software. Currently, there isn't. And I'll continue to investigate this, and if I come up with something, I'll let the audience know. But do know that all the shows, all 318 now with this one, are available from the website. You do have to download them. You can either listen to them right on the website, or if you have a pod player of some sort, you can download them. You end up having to right-click or control-click where it says download to save it to your computer and then transfer it somehow to whatever pod player, iPhone, iPod, iPad that you're listening with. Okay, I hope that wasn't too long and rambling, but I think it was. Next, we hear from Michael in Germany who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Today, driving home from a client, I listened to the episode number 308 about your experiences with synchronicity in your life. It was, as so often, very interesting, and as you are a born storyteller, very entertaining. I find the story amazing, especially with the phone call you got from Sonoma. Unbelievable. Also, the other events," he's talking about the phone call I got from the chair of the psychology department at Sonoma State University, if that helps you to remember my long personal story in episode 308. "Unbelievable," he writes. "Also, the other events with the psychic must have been strange. While listening to the interview, I suddenly had to think about something Viktor Frankl said in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, which I recently read after having it a long time on my to-read list. Thanks for mentioning that book in your podcast so often that I had to read it." Good, I'm glad. Yeah, I do keep referring to it, even though it's probably been, well, I won't say how many years, but I only read it once, and that was a very long time ago, but it made a lasting impression on me. He goes on to write, "One thing that he mentioned in his book was that young people have the future, which is always uncertain to look forward to, but older people have the past that they can look back to, and the past is certain, and no one can take away what has been experienced." But failing memory can, I should add. "This can give someone a good feeling of the meaning that someone has accomplished in his life. Viktor Frankl's meaning in life was to help others find theirs. Maybe I'm a bit too curious now, but I'll take the chance. Have you been able, after a life full of some many wonderful stories and experiences, to find the," and he's written it in capitals, "the meaning in your life? Whether or not you answer such a question, I would like to thank you for sharing parts of your life story and for helping me through Shrink Wrap Radio to give my life more meaning." He goes on to say, "Regarding synchronicity, I'm not sure yet what to believe. Personally, I never had such big synchronicities as you had, but still I remember a few smaller ones. One of the things I believe, when something does not work out the way I planned and I need to make other plans, it probably will be better than the initial plan, and most of the time things will work out better than first envisioned. Something will come up, some solution will offer itself. Is that also synchronicity?" I'm not sure I would define that as synchronicity, frankly. At the end of the podcast, you mentioned that when you listened back to the episodes, you thought maybe that the ahs and ohs, I'm not sure if you mean the ahs and ohs or the ahs and ums, were maybe a little irritating. During the listening to the interview, I thought, as a German, that this was typical American and over the top, and it did not sound authentic to me. So I was glad that you yourself found it also irritating, but it was not so bad, in my opinion, just the European way. Ha ha. I'm actually a little confused by that passage, to tell you the truth. I'm not quite sure what you mean. Last point, I had to stop using Podcast Box as it did not really work out for me. I'm now using iCatcher, which is more stable and user-friendly. For example, I can read all the show notes, and it only costs 79 cents. Actually, in the U.S., it costs, I think, $1.99, because I downloaded it on your recommendation. I haven't checked it out yet, though. And he closes, and again, thanks for your great work. And that's from Michael in Germany. And Michael, want to respond to your question about the, have I found the meaning of my life? And boy, I'm not sure about the meaning. I have to tell you that doing this podcast series feels like a very big part of whatever the meaning of my life might be. It definitely seems to pull on all my talents and past experiences. And so, as much as anything else, I look at this as a what's the word I'm looking for, as a manifestation of the meaning of my life, and of course also my children and grandchildren and all of that. So that's my answer, whether it's satisfying or not. Next, we hear from Dr. George, who I interviewed on Wise Counsel about somatic experiencing. And he wrote me just this wonderful endorsement or recommendation on iTunes, and he sent me a copy. And so far, he's tried several times to submit it to iTunes, and it's just not showing up, and neither one of us can figure out why. And I was so moved by the heartiness of his recommendation that I wanted to share it somehow with the world. So I'm sharing it with you, my special friends, right now. And he writes to say, I submitted it to iTunes, that is, but at first it said error next to the 5 stars. So I resubmitted it, and it said thanks next to those stars. I have no way to know if it went through, however. Here's the text of my review, George says. I've been a university psychology professor and practicing psychologist for 37 years, and I've yet to find another psychology resource that is as much fun and painlessly informative as this podcast. Dr. Dave has superb interviewing skills, gently questioning his guests and adding his own insight from his own vast experience as a clinical psychologist and university professor. As a former guest on his Wise Counsel podcast, I experienced his graceful interviewing style myself and came away feeling I'd been talking by the fireside to an old friend. Dr. Dave fearlessly explores a wide range of theoretical viewpoints, holding his own viewpoint aside while he delves into the mysteries of the psyche and human behavior. I've assigned this podcast to my university classes, and students love it, as do I. Even though I have familiarity with many of the ideas presented, there's always something new here to learn, something fascinating on the cutting edge that is so exciting to know about. I highly recommend this podcast for anyone who wants to experience the many amazing ideas in psychology. And that's from Dr. George Lau, L-O-U-G-H. And he has a podcast at Well, I'm not sure if this is his podcast, but I think you'll find it there. www.askdrgeorge.com. And certainly the feeling was very mutual on my part of feeling like we were old friends sitting by the fireside. And I feel that we would be really good friends if we lived closer together. And it means so much to me to get this kind of recognition from a fellow psychologist and psychotherapist. So thanks again, Dr. George, and let's stay in touch. So we'll wrap it up with that. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And in addition to emails, you can also leave your comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Nancy Rappaport, for her insights on understanding problem kids, both at home and in the school setting. My next interview will be with Dr. Paul Swingle, author of the 2008 book, Biofeedback for the Brain, and we'll be discussing the branch of biofeedback known as neurotherapy. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.